Check engine, ABS, or maintenance light on? Take the guesswork out of your warning lights with O'Reilly Veriscan. The service is free and provides a report with solutions verified by ASE-certified master technicians. And if you need help, we could recommend a shop for you. Ask for O'Reilly Veriscan today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Welcome everyone to this special episode of Kiwi Talks to review Hollow Knight Silksong. I am joined today by Joe Houston, a famous man who has worked on games such as Titanfall, Dishonored, Shadow of the Colossus, Uncharted, the Nathan Drake Collection, and of course, Demon's Souls. How you doing, man?
I'm doing good. Good to be back.
Yeah, good to have you back. So I thought just best to get into it, man. How did you find this game overall? Easy, difficult, both.
Big fan of Hollow Knight. I kind of found it organically when it came out. I wasn't part of the crowdfunding or anything like that. So I was one of those who was really stoked and anticipating this game for a long time. I would say for the most part, it exceeded my expectations. I also have all kinds of feelings about it at the same time, which I would say that's like a gamer thing. My kiddo is playing the new Pokemon game and they are complaining about it constantly. And they've had it for like a week and they've logged like 50 hours on it. And I'm like, you sound like you hate the game, but you can't stop playing it. I think that there were moments of that for me on Silksong, where obviously I'm super deep in this game, but there were moments where I was just like, oh my god.
Yeah, exactly how I feel, pretty much. What were the things that annoyed you first? Because I like to end on a positive note, so let's start with the bad stuff first.
So it's as a game developer especially, I drive my wife crazy with these things because she's like, what bothers you? And then I was like, well, let me take you back to, let me refer to all these other games and these ideas and whatever. But that is the way that I think about it. I would say that broadly speaking, and I'm sure a lot of people are talking about it, the difficulty is a big part of this game.
Yeah.
It's like what you like about it. It's what you don't like about it. The part where I get frustrated, and not the frustrated like I died 100 times to the beast fly or whatever, like where I feel like the game confuses me or maybe lets me down a little bit is it's like, what is the role of difficulty in a game, right? It can do a lot of things. It can be there to teach the player. It's going to teach you how to play the game so that it can throw new stuff at you later, so you can enjoy the game more after you get past this hurdle or this like teaching moment. It can be about creating a community, right? Like, I beat this thing and now I can talk with other people. We can share this frustration. That can happen in like a multiplayer game. That can happen in a single player game. Like whatever. And then it can also be, and I think that this is where, when it works in Silksong, I really appreciate, is it creates an experience, right? Like say there's this encounter where they're throwing waves and waves of enemies at you, and you've done this before, three or four waves. It's really, they can be really hard, but you get through it and now you've learned how all the enemies work, and that's awesome. But there's one where it was like 11 waves of enemies, and like after 5, you're like, oh my god, there's another. And then 6, and you're like, are you kidding me? And then they drop a boss in the middle and you're like, holy crap. And then, but that each one of those beats is the thing, like, you're going to talk about, you're going to have this experience that you share. You had a big emotional high, whether it made you feel pissed in the moment or whatever. And I think the moment where I realized that there was something wrong like late in the game was I was doing one of those and it was just piling stuff on, and then they dropped in like two or three big enemies where I had just fought like one, and I just went I wasn't having an experience, I wasn't engaging with it, I was like, oh, this bullshit again.
Yeah.
Is what I felt like, and I was like, I know I'll get through it, I know I'll grind it, I know I'll figure it out. I was no longer engaged. I was just like, okay, sure. And I do feel like that there was too much of that late in the game. I would say it's where it crossed from novelty into endurance. It's like, how much of this will you endure and still stick with the game? That's where the balance was off for me a little bit. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of put it as like it's a 9 out of 10 game with a 7 out of 10 paint job.
Yeah.
That's what I refer to it as, meaning like the design is great, the progression's great, the music's great, animation, all that stuff, but there's just the stuff around the edge that that just infuriates me. And the difficulty was definitely one part of it. I think the other big one is runbacks as well. Particularly, what is it, the Groll, the Great, and the Last Judge. But it also depends on how much you die, right, as to how infuriating you'll find those runbacks. And obviously this is a thing that's in Souls games. You probably know this from the Demon Souls days. But yeah, I found the difficulty infuriating at times, because sometimes it feels like it's just trolling you, almost.
And again, like, I agree, but I would say that the adversarial role of the design versus the player is fun and funny and cool at parts. Like when you make your way through Hunter's March and you sit on the bench and it hits you with a trap, like it's very explicit. It's just like, gotcha. And you know, you'll remember that. You'll talk about that. That's an experience that you had as a player. But there are places where it's like it's embedded into the design that a run back is essentially a penalty for death, right?
Yeah.
Like that's, you know, so it's fun when they build a whole narrative, like in Hunter's March, and that's that's like part of a crafted experience. It's different when you're fighting, say, Lost Lace, you know, and there's no run back, but they make you sit and watch all the opening animations over and over and over again. They're like, well, there's nowhere for us to have you do a run back, so we'll just make you watch these animations. And it's just a penalty, right? It's not serving a purpose other than just being a naked penalty. And as a gamer, that's not especially fun, you know. There's a famous story in game design circles of a MMO where they had a new mechanic that they rolled out where it was a penalty for being unrested, so that they were trying to convince you to log out and log in, I think to distribute a player like server load or something like that, and so you would get less experience if you've been playing for longer, and players hated it. So they made a switch only in name to make it a bonus for when you're well rested. It was the exact same thing. It's just they changed the messaging around it, which is that if you just logged in, you get extra experience and then you go back to normal, as opposed to normal is when you're first logged in and then it's a penalty. And then players loved it. Nothing changed. It was the exact same mechanic, but it's like how you feel about it. And watching an opening like cinematic, you know, and like the title cards, and like that's all in there, I think, intentionally. And that's where it's just like you just feel like you're being, again, like how much of this will you put up with, which I don't think anybody likes that.
Yeah, well, I saw in the credits there were only 6 playtesters on the game, which seems insanely small for a game of that size. Because what? It's like a 30, 40 hour game? And that's without even 100%ing it, I would think. It could be more depending on how much you die.
It was way more for me, for what it's worth.
Well, it was obviously an issue because I remember after it came out, there were mods for the PC version. Like 2 days after it came out, like there was the mask damage because pretty much everything took off like two masks, right? Mm-hmm. And then there was checkpoints as well because it seems to be something that's very divisive online. Because some, as you've mentioned, it's something you either love or you hate. I tend to get quite frustrated if I keep dying. And especially like with run backs, though, it depends on how long the run back is. But I feel like it interrupts game flow because you have to get back to the thing you actually want to do. So, I mean, I don't know how many times I did run backs for The Last Judge. It must have been like 25 times or something. And I just wanted to get back to challenge it again. And so, yeah, I was getting a bit frustrated. And how did you find the bosses?
Yeah, love-hate relationship with the bosses. I think the sheer quantity of them is really impressive. There are a lot of bosses. They're all individually designed. You know, I think that intermixing them with enemies, I think that that can be controversial because I think some people think it's lazy, but I actually found those boss fights to be the most interesting because, you know, writ large, I think for a game like this, pattern recognition and then learning patterns is just like a big part of the boss process, and that gets old really fast. So putting in enemies so that there's just way more variety and like randomness, I actually did appreciate. However, and again, this I think that if you're gonna do 10 times on a boss, that's one experience you're gonna have. If you're going to do 20 times on a boss, if you're going to do more than 20 times on a boss, that experience becomes just draining.
Yeah, I agree.
I would say that I was at a disadvantage too because I'm a old guy. I'm a parent. So you're I'm on old. Dad time. Well, game industry wise, pretty old.
Yeah.
And But what it means is that I, you know, maybe I have an hour to play a game. Let's say I'm stuck on a boss. So then I go and I get the crap kicked out of me on the boss like immediately because I'm not warmed up. And then I do the run back. And so then maybe five attempts in, I'm like, okay, I'm at the point now where I can see that I can beat this boss. And then I get like two more tries and then my lunch break is over. And so then I just do that over and over again. So I'm getting like two or three good reps on a boss like every time I play, even though I'm spending an hour or more each time. So I don't, you know, that's not going to be true for every fan, but it was true for this fan, and it was pretty brutal.
Well, yeah, and because when you die, you lose like your rosaries. Is it the currency, the rosaries? And if you don't get back to where you died, then you basically lose everything. And so it's kind of like a domino effect of the more you die, the harder it actually gets in a way.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have thoughts just in general about the overall progression of difficulty. Because I think it's say, yeah, the bosses are hard. The environments can be hard. But I think that there's a design idea in the game where when you give away rewards, because it's a game about exploration, so why do you explore? You explore to get more stuff. You get more story beats. You get more exposure to the world. Sure, great. You also get stuff. In this case, it's mask shards. It's the silk shards or spool shards. It's and then it's crests and it's stuff to put in the crests. And so One thing that I did notice about Silksong is that I think it's very carefully designed such that it mostly reward you with tools to express yourself in the game, ways to strategize, but never, almost never, ways to make the game easier. Mask shards and the silk container pieces are probably the main thing that in theory makes the game easier. But like you said, you know, enemies are taking off two mask hits at a time. So even getting a whole new mask, it's usually it's like, okay, well, I've still died the exact same amount. Like yeah. You have to get two masks in order to make a difference. It is interesting to me that we have so many tools, so many different things to exchange and interplay, you know, to play the game. And to me, they didn't make an enormous difference in the overall difficulty. It was more like they enabled me to play new ways if I wanted to, which I appreciated. But at the same time, after the game was pretty expressive, like because I'd gotten a lot of stuff, I stopped getting as excited about getting more stuff because it's like, okay, another crest that has significant downsides and significant upsides and doesn't make me stronger necessarily. And also like this one takes away my ability to navigate in the environment. And it was everything just is completely traded off and balanced, which I can appreciate. But also as a player, seldom did I get a thing and I was like, oh, sick. You know?
Yeah, fair enough. Was there one part of the game where you felt it stood out, like a highlight of the game, where you're like, ah, oh, this is good? You put up with the frustration because of bits like this.
Yeah. Actually, stuff like sitting on that bench in Hunter's March and getting and getting the trap, and then I actually think that stuff does work really well in the game. That big long ass waves and waves of enemies thing where I was just like, I cannot believe they're doing this to me. Like those were important moments to me. On top of that, the story is something that I was very invested in. The world I was very invested in. I had mixed feelings about us losing a silent protagonist and getting a player who is who has like a really strong personality. But I actually loved her. I loved playing as Hornet. The expressiveness in the movesets from like the different crests and stuff like that. The fact that the down pogo is now like off to the side by default. I actually loved that like right away. It was a quirk, and I know that hung some people up quite a bit. So I do think that your like personal experience with this game is going to be different, you know?
Yeah.
But the world that they built and the characters in it were one of my favorite things about the game. And Hornet is a great character because she has such a strong personality, I think, because there's the way I feel about it and there's the way Hornet feels about it. And actually I think it works that they're so different because it's like, ah, I feel bad about this situation, and Hornet's like, basically, you're on your own. You know, which isn't something that I would say, but and there was a sense of humor in the game that I really appreciated. You know, like someone is flirting with Hornet and she just like smacks him across the face. and they don't do that too often too. You know, they choose the tone of the game really carefully. That worked for me really well.
Yeah, and there's a lot of world building within the story as well, right? And environmental storytelling. Like, is it Underworks where they had the renting benches?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
To kind of signify the different class, I guess, the further up you go. And I love the mobility of Hornet. She's obviously more mobile than the Knight. And they had some cool things with the moveset. Yeah, that pogo, that messed me up in the beginning, especially in Hunter's March, where you have to bounce off the, what is it, the flowers? Yeah. I kept missing it. There is that upgrade you get, though, which makes it a hell of a lot easier. But yeah, I remember that. I was getting so frustrated with that. And I'm like, man, are my reflexes terrible? Am I needing better glasses? Like, oh, yeah, it was pretty frustrating. Do you have a specific biome, an area that stands out to you?
Hollow Knight was good at this, and I think Silk Song is too, is that you kind of think that the world is all going to be pretty level, even, equal amount of griminess, and it's actually got a lot of variety to it. So I do like the interplay. Probably emotional beats, Bone Bottom and everything those poor bugs went through was a big highlight. For actually like being in the world and experiencing it, the Citadel, you know, like the Coral Chambers.
Yeah, the music is amazing, I thought.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And I say the Marrow and Deep Docks, like there's a few hidden areas. I don't know how deep we go into spoiler territory. I guess we're already
there. Yeah, we can go there.
The whispering something, what is it called? The fire area with the big burning effigy. Did you find that?
Oh, yeah, yeah. What's it called? Mind blank.
Yeah. Well, either way,
we know what it is. Yeah.
Yeah, that was a pretty impactful experience. Also like that there was variety there in that, you know, the effigy didn't give you silk back. So it was just like, hey, here's, and it didn't overstay its welcome. I actually think that's something that Silk Song, I think in general, could have worked on is, like when you do a new thing, don't just keep doing it over and over and over again. And that's a place where they didn't. I think that's a very, that was one of the only places where you were facing enemies that didn't give you silk for hitting them. So for just that one encounter, that was it was basically a new modifier on the combat. And so I remember it as like a cool thing, as opposed to, oh yeah, that was something I had to deal with from that point on.
Yeah, because how did you find Demon Souls? Like, was there stuff that you took from working on Demon Souls which made you, I suppose, a little bit more heightened in regards to Silk Song in terms of the way you look at certain things, both good and bad?
Demon Souls was an important point in the industry. I literally worked on a game on Dishonored where our entire mantra was we used to post, it was posted on the wall, say yes to the player. And the thinking behind that was that if the player wants to do a thing, make it so that the environment responds to that. That they say, yes, you can do that. You can express yourself in every way that you can think of. And we had a bunch of like do's and don'ts, you know, like basically there was one that was like, don't put ladders in the game. You'll probably fall to your death anyway. They were like these motivational poster type things. And accessibility in that regard, I think it was becoming just accepted that you had to make a game accessible in order for it to be successful. And Demon's Souls, when it first came out, kind of showed that there was another way to do it, which is like, this is our world, this is how our world works, just, you know, get it or get wrecked, basically. and that was actually a very rewarding and interesting and fun way to play too. It doesn't, like, I am still very proud of Dishonored, and I think that's a really fun game. It's just like a different way to play. So starting with Demon's Souls as a player and then later working on the remake, I think that's why my view of difficulty in games is so nuanced, because Silksong very explicitly is like, this is the world that we've created. We don't expect you to like it all the time, but we do expect you to have a reaction to it. So when it did let me down, it was only because I stopped having a reaction to it. Like when Bone Bottom first got torn to pieces, you know, I was just like, oh my God, why? And my kid was watching me play, and right before you open the bell doors and the last judge comes down and kills all those bugs that are waiting to get in.
Yep.
That we start opening the door and they're all there singing, and my kiddo's just like, they're not gonna die, are they? I was like, I don't know, probably. And they were like, no, I don't want them to die. It's like, I don't know if they're going to die. And then the last judge comes down and they go, brah! And they went, no! And the thing is that's an experience that you're not, you know, they're not going to get that in Pokemon.
No, I mean, definitely not.
That is what you play this game for, is moments like that.
Yeah, because there's a bit of a debate as to whether this game should have accessibility options, which is part of the reason why I bring up Demon's Souls as well, because I'm sure when you guys were working on the remake, you had discussions as to whether to make it easier or not for less skilled players.
That was definitely something that we talked about in other games, and we did do. We had an easier version of Uncharted 1, because it was a bit of a difficulty spike compared to the other games. I think we had an explorer difficulty level for all three, but 1 was the one that needed it the most. And kind of it actually needed a bit of a difficulty rebalance throughout. And it was something that everyone said when it came out the first time. And same for Shadow, I believe. I know we worked on it. I think it released with it. With Demon's Souls, no. I told you just can't. You can't do that. I think that if we were the original developers on Demon's Souls, we could certainly have that discussion. And to be clear, Team Cherry knows what they're doing. They released a patch where they dialed back the praying mantis boss, the mother, whatever her name is.
Sister Splinter, is it?
Sisters, yes, yeah, that's one. Yeah. Thank you. They dialed her back a little bit, and I saw a little discourse online that's like, well, why? They obviously hate us. It's like, no, they don't. They want to bring you along for this bigger ride. Like they are. They're doing it on purpose, for sure. And they love you as a player. They do. They built this thing for you, even as they're just like ramming your face into the dirt sometimes.
And I suppose they'd probably want them to at least try and get to Act 2, right? Because I think a lot of people did drop it because they found Act 1 too difficult. Which is not entirely their fault, because obviously the hype behind this game was just insane levels, right? Like GTA of indies type thing. And I think a lot of people bought into the hype, not knowing what they were getting themselves into, because I imagine there were a lot of players that never played Hollow Knight. And so, I mean, the game starts off, it gets quite difficult quite rapidly compared to Hollow Knight, mm-hmm. I felt.
Yeah, I believe it did. I think that you have some choices as a game developer, right, with a game like that, which is that it did, I think you're right, it did get a bunch of notoriety, so now it has a chance to reach a much broader fan base, and do you go for that broader fan base, or do you stay true to what made the game popular and successful in the first place. And where do you draw that line? Like that is a difficult discussion. I work for Riot Games now, and it's written everywhere. It's like it's publicly available, but if you go to apply at Riot, they'll redirect you on their website to a page about the Riot core values. And one of the core values of Riot is serve the core and player first, basically, which is that Riot builds games around like who are the core audience, the people who are going to or are playing your game, like 1,000+ hours, and make the game for them. And it's one of those things where it's a choice, because accessibility will suffer if you're focusing on these people, but you will build games for that group of people that are unlike anything they could get anywhere else. And then you hope that that's a strategy that works out for you. I will say it doesn't mean you don't worry about accessibility at all, because like you said, if you're going to build your game for your 1,000+ hour fan base, you have to make sure that you're making some. Like, they need to get to 1,000 hours.
Yeah, well,
if they
right.
bounce off your game and are like, I hate this game, and you know, then the strategy doesn't work. But you know, how much do you have to court them? It's tricky. I would say that I didn't have any trouble getting to Act 2. I started really feeling the slog Act 2 to Act 3, actually. I would say it was when I was starting to be like kind of feeling like it was a little too much. So
there's a bit of a discussion in terms of like games, and I've spoken to a lot of devs about this, with some games being too long. Like sometimes mm-hmm. you can feel like some devs pad out the game because for a number of reasons, right? They just want to keep adding stuff to the game, or it might be that in order to justify this price, it needs to be this many hours. I don't think Team Cherry falls into that category. I think they just wanted to keep adding stuff. And they're probably getting to the point where like, yeah, we should probably release this now. It's been like 8 years. Because the game is really very good in terms of value for what you pay, for the amount of hours. But I was starting to feel towards the end, I'm like, this game is a bit too long, I feel.
So when did you start feeling it was too long? I'm curious.
Nearing the end of Act 2. Like Act 3, like, yeah, I don't know. I feel like maybe it could have been condensed into Act 2. Granted, I mean, you don't actually have to do Act 3, right? You can actually complete the game in Act 2. Because how many endings? There's 4 endings, I think. It's 4 different endings.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But I mean, by the same token, you don't want a game that's too short as well.
I think a lot of times game length is like how much can you produce if it's too short, sure. But if it's too long, what do you get rid of? A lot of times it's not like, oh, they could have stopped here. It's like, what should they have cut? Because that happens a lot in game development. There's a lot of stuff that you just don't release. You're like, this would distract. This isn't enough. This isn't going where we want it to go. And so you cut it. So I think an interesting thought exercise is like, what would we have cut from Hollow Knight?
Yeah, well, I suppose that's a good point. I'd have to really think deeply about it. Do you think that the amount of bosses was right? Do you think you needed that amount of bosses?
I think the game's too long. I think that it felt too long to me. And it's specifically because of that variety thing that I was talking about before, which is that I started experiencing more content, which was well made, but it was very similar. I just wasn't feeling like I was having a new experience with it. So it's like, oh, I'm going to do this again. So I think where that redundancy was, that's where I would have cut. This is one of those weird things where I really like the game, and I've like 97% on it or something, like on completion. And I'm kind of wondering, like, maybe I shouldn't have gotten all the secrets, like, as I went, because by the time I got to the end of Act 3, I was really burned out. Which is weird, because normally if I love a game and I'm getting all the secrets, by the time it's over, I'm just like, oh, I can't believe there's nothing left. Like, what will I now do with my life? And I didn't have that experience with Silksong.
Do you replay games much? Or are you like a one and done guy?
Certain genres are just nothing but replays, and I play a lot of those. Like, I like roguelikes a lot. So that, like, what a friend of mine hates the term roguelike. He likes to call them sessional games, and you know, just because he thinks the term ceases to have meaning. I think he kind of has a point. Basically, just a game where you have a full experience in one session of the game, you know, a little bit more than like an arcade experience or something like that, where there are real stakes and decisions and everything. Those are games I like a lot. So, yeah, I'm replaying those constantly. For narrative games, seldom. I seldom replay them again. There are some – that's not true. I do replay my favorites like every 5 to 10 years. Like, I've played Symphony of the Night like 5 times.
Well, I mean, it's basically designed that way, right? To be replayed. Mm-hmm. A lot of Metroidvania games are. And you can like speed run and all that sort of stuff. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if you're talking about like a 100-hour game, replaying it, I probably wouldn't do that. I think I'd be a one and done. And I don't know if I would play Silksong again. Maybe with mods.
I think I would probably... I might try speed running Act 1 or something like that. I could see that being a thing. The problem is that there's so many awesome games now.
Mm.
That's a big ask, I think, to be like, don't have new experiences with these new titles. Don't find out more about what's going on in having conversation with other gamers instead to go do something that you already know. That's just for me personally, though.
Yeah, that makes sense. And there's so much stuff that's come out within the last few months. I think with GTA 6 moving to next year, I think everybody just rushed to release in that like third, fourth quarter, I think, now that it was freed up. There is a lot to play. Was there a boss that you died on the most?
I think that the beast fly in Hunter's March. I don't know why. There were bosses where I was like 3 attempts in. I was like, I get it. We'll get it. And then I just would die over and over and over. And that was one of them where every time I was like, why am I dying on this thing?
Yeah, because you have to have such good reflexes with that boss fight. And there are a number of bosses where the boss itself actually isn't that difficult. But when it mm-hmm. spawns enemies
yeah.
that appear, that's what actually messes you up. And what is it? The beast fly. Yeah, is mm-hmm. one of those. Yeah. I totally relate. Yeah. Beast Fly would definitely be up there.
I think that 10 or 11 wave fight in the coral chambers where they had the big baddie in the middle, and then you fight two of them again at the end.
Yeah.
That one spiked my blood pressure so hard. But overall, it was like I said, I took away from that, like, wow, that's an experience I haven't had in a game in recent memory.
Yeah, and a lot of the boss fights are very unique as well. There's not a lot of times I felt they were too samey.
Mm-hmm.
They managed to find unique ways to do stuff with mechanics and so forth. Like the cogwork dances, I thought was an interesting one with the, you know, it's like this and then it goes like this and then like that. And
yeah,
just interesting ideas. So that stuff was cool. Do you think it'll be nominated for Game of the Year, and do you think it'll win Game of the Year?
Yeah, I think it'll be nominated for sure. Will it win? I don't know. It's a good question. What'll it be up against? Blueprints, I'm sure, will get nominated.
Expedition 33.
The Expedition 33.
Well, I think that'll win Game of the Year, I think, personally.
I think you need broad appeal to win Game of the Year. And
do
I
you?
Think...
I don't know. Astrobot wasn't... I mean, it sold like 2 million units.
That's the definition of accessible, right? Who hates Astrobot?
But it didn't sell that well. I remember when it won, because I thought it was going to win. I thought it was going to win, and I even predicted it would win. But I remember the meltdown when it did win, because people were expecting Final Fantasy or Black Myth Wukong to win, because obviously Black Myth Wukong sold like 20 million units or something, and Astrobot won, and it had only sold 2 million. But then it's more accessible, but it didn't sell as much so as some of the other games. So I don't know. Like Expedition 33 to me seems like the darling of the industry in the same way Baldur's Gate 3 was in 2023.
They're very similar stories in the sense that they are genres that I think publishers have considered dead, and they came back and blew those expectations out of the water, and then they're beloved by fans and they're gorgeous, and it's just who doesn't love getting behind that story, especially if you are a fan of the so-called dead genre, which is just like, yeah, screw you. Expedition 33, I haven't played it all the way through, but just its existence makes me really happy as a game developer. And then I, you know, just playing through the opening, it's like, oh my god, it's just bringing all the feels just immediately, and so earnestly made too. It's easy to get jaded, but I think it was exactly the kind of game that that you want to be successful as a game developer.
Yeah,
really. And Astrobot also, I would throw that in there, just if you're a fan of those kinds of games, which I am deeply, like, again, that was just such a love letter to that whole genre. And again, just there was so much heart in it, even though it was a big corporate product and had a huge team behind it and everything like that. Just such a breath of fresh air.
Yeah, I sometimes do wonder if, like, what wins Game of the Year is also dependent upon like the message maybe that they're trying to send to the industry as well. Like I sometimes feel that with like, and particularly with Astrobot's case, that they were sending a message that not every game needs to be like a $200 million budgeted game. Mm-hmm. You know, you can still have a really, really great game with a smaller budget and with heart to it. So I'll be interested to see. I don't think Silksong will win. I think the difficulty might have rubbed some people the wrong way, but I mean, it got a lot of good reviews from critics. There were a couple of critics though that slammed it for its perceived difficulty or unbalanced nature, I guess. And it does appear to be quite divisive online from stuff mm-hmm. that I've read. So it's hard to know.
If you think about it, picking Game of the Year is kind of an insane thing to do when, like, Grand Theft Auto, Candy Crush, Balatro, Astrobot, like, they're all in the same, like, they're all, like, which one's the best? And it's like, these things are so different from each other. It's weird that they're all competing, you know, in the same category. And it is going to be so specific about taste, because I think what makes Silksong a good game, what made Demon's Souls a revolutionary game, was that it was specific. It was like, we are going to do something, we're going to do it the way that we think we want to make it. And it turned out there were a whole bunch of people who were like, yeah, I'll play that. And the reason that they like it is the same reason that everyone else hates it. And I kind of think that's where the best games are made, honestly, which is like, hey, this is what we're going to do, and we're going to go super deep on it. And that gives you an opportunity to make something special. You know, if you're going to try and make something that every human being on the planet is going to think is great, well, if we knew what that was, there'd be no war anymore, right? We'd have people all figured out. Well, we'd have them all just play, Expedition 33, I guess.
Well, yeah, I mean, Souls-likes are just, by their very nature, they are difficult. So,
yeah.
It also depends on the type of gamer you are. I think I'm finding as I get older, I'm liking them less, primarily because I have less time. So yeah. I don't want to spend time playing a game where I have to die over and over again. I don't know if you feel the same as you're getting older.
I am. in some ways, I'm like, roguelikes they fill that niche for me because they can have high stakes. They can have big high highs, or they can have high highs and low lows. They can have a whole journey, and you can do it all in 2 hours or an hour or even 30 minutes and then move on with your life. So I think that is a great way to still be a part of this conversation. But yeah, long, sprawling, just endurance games. I would say quite some of Silksong is an endurance game, and I did not like that about it. And maybe it's just not for me now.
But you, when you were younger, could you see yourself having a different take on it?
Probably.
I think I could. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because I find that a lot of the games that I used to play as a kid that were very, very difficult, if I go back and play them now as an adult, I just suck at them. But I didn't when I was younger. And I'm like, is it my reflexes? Have I just got complacent with this stuff? Like, I don't know. And my tolerance as well is lessened.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, even like story-based games, you know, new Final Fantasy's out, and it's like, there's 100 plus hours of story content, and I, in my head, I go, oh no, there is no way that I'm gonna play that. Like, I just don't have that time. But when I was a kid, I was like, oh my god, yes, I'm gonna be so excited to be a part of this world for that long, you know.
Yeah, and one of the problems I have with story games now is if I play it and I get immersed somewhat in the story, and then for whatever reason something happens and I don't get back to it for 2 weeks, I can sometimes forget the story and what's going on. That happened to me numerous times with like the Mass Effect games, where I'd be like, wait, what's going on? Who are these characters? I have no idea what I'm doing. It just completely blank. So yeah, it's still something I'm trying to figure out as I get older, what sort of games maybe resonate more with my lifestyle. Yeah. Like, I think Silksong is the type of game you can pick up and just play it and you'll be all good. And then you can put it down if it's frustrating you to some degree, you know.
Is the put down and pick up game a thing anymore, though? Not because the game isn't, but because there's so many available options. Like, if you put a game down, what are the chances that you'll come back to it rather than just play something else?
Well, I can't speak for everyone.
Open question.
I don't like to not finish a game. Unless it's sure. Like, I feel like I'm not getting anything out of this, or it's disrespecting my time. Then I'll put it down. Especially if I paid money for it. And I've had a discussion before with a Bethesda dev about this in terms of Game Pass, right? Like, I don't have Game Pass. But if I did have Game Pass, I would have less of a reason to finish a game because I don't feel like I'm paying for it. You know, you're kind of like hiring a game, so if I drop it, it's not that much of an issue. But like, when you're paying money for a game, especially if it's full price, right, day one, I feel compelled to finish it because I paid all this money for it.
I think it's a good point about the models, the distribution models for games affects our commitment level with them, which is a game design challenge for developers as well, which is like, you got to get them, you know, and if you challenge a player too much, like maybe they'll just drop it. It was a big problem for a while with all these bundles, like Humble Bundles or whatever. It's like, here's 50 indie games. And it's like, okay, I'm going to play each one 30 seconds. And if it isn't immediately amazing, and maybe it's got something in there, but like, you know, you don't experience it in 5 minutes. Then yeah, you're just like, okay, I'm going to move on. Whereas yeah, if you spent $20 on it, you're going to give it a try. You're going to let it make its case.
Yeah, and as I mentioned before, I think Silksong is priced amazingly well for the amount of content you get from it. I think Team Cherry obviously made the game that they wanted to make, and they had the luxury to be able to do it because all the devs are basically millionaires, so they could just take their time on it. Obviously, some devs do not have that option, and as a result, they might incorporate accessibility options to try and widen the reach and sales and stuff. So it does become a bit of a discussion point. My thinking is still on the balancing, though. I think they, because I know some people that know the guys, mm-hmm. and they basically just locked themselves in a basement for like 8 years and just disconnected themselves from the rest of the world to make this thing. And didn't really pay any attention to social media or what was going on in the industry or anything, and they just made the game they wanted to make. And so I'm thinking some of the playtesters got so good at the game that maybe they didn't realize that there were some difficulties in spots. But obviously, if I ever had the chance to interview the guys, I would ask them straight up. But I'll cross that path when I come to it. But that's just my theory.
Well, I'll tell you, having worked on games, that it is absolutely a thing when the development team gets tired of something because they've played it for too long. Yeah. They just start changing it because they're sick of it. And you never got to see the thing they got tired of, you know, because they played it for 3 years and they were like, let's change it. It's a very real thing that you have to talk about, which is like, hey, are we just sick of this, you know, or is it really bad?
But that's what playtesters are for, right? Like, I don't know how many playtesters you had. Like, what was the maximum amount of playtesters you had on one of the games you worked on?
Play testing, like external play testing.
Sometimes it's internal.
So internal play testing is all the time, but those people are with you. You know, they're playing the game as much as you are, and they get tired of the game as much as you do. So like if you have internal QA or something like that, which are often going to be your experts, you know, they're the ones with the most hours in the game. Their opinion matters a lot, but also they do tire on the game for sure. External play testing has the opposite problem because it's always new people. Not always. Sometimes you can get the same people back. But either way, they're not going to have as much time with it. And it's a much smaller sample size. It is surprisingly hard to know what you have when you're working on it. I've worked on projects where publishers will often do a mock review where they'll actually hire a game journalist. They're not paying for a review. They hire a journalist to write a review for them as though it were for print, and then they burn it. They just read it, and they're like, okay, here's what a games journalist would give us on this game right now. And so there's tons of stuff that you do to try and understand what you have, and you can still just miss it. I actually know of a game where I think a lot of the time is that the publisher or the developers caught flat-footed, like the game has problems that they didn't know about. But I've actually seen it where the publisher had no faith in a game because they were certain that it wasn't good. And then it then it came out and it was a big hit. Like, that can actually happen too.
That's not surprising. But then, like, the people who are running these publishers, like, how much do they spend time playing these games, or is it like delegated to other people and then they make a decision based on that feedback? Because I imagine the CEOs of these publishers, they're not playing these games.
Well, probably not.
No,
especially since there's so many, they've got so many projects going on at once. It varies, you know. There are things I can and can't say, but I will tell you, at Riot, I don't know anyone there who doesn't play. That's specifically a Riot thing. Like, you're supposed to play the games. if anyone wants to apply, you're gonna have to play. But you know, like, when I worked for ZeniMax, I doubt very much that Robert Altman played Dishonored or whatever. he had a lot else going on.
Yeah, totally. But, like, obviously Todd was high up in the chain and he definitely would have played.
Oh, yeah.
It. Yeah.
Yeah. The creative guys all, the creative people all, they're gamers for sure.
Yeah, so it's obviously one of those things that's very hard to get right. But I suppose one of the good things about the digital age is you have patches, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you can introduce patches. I mean, Team Cherry have done a few now. A lot of it's mainly bugs, as far as I can recall, and there's like a couple of nerfs. But I don't imagine they'll introduce like an accessibility mode or something, like an easy mode.
Oh, I'd be shocked.
Yeah, and I think the fandom would have a meltdown.
Like, what are they motivated by? They've sold millions of copies of the game.
Yeah,
totally.
They have no reason to do that. And as you mentioned before, that's not the core, right? They'll be thinking about the core people. Unless they've got data that indicates that people aren't getting past Act 1 or something, like if, I don't know, like 80% of the people weren't getting past Act 1, then maybe you'd look at it. But you'd be able to get data quite quickly, especially from Steam. They'd be providing that data. I don't actually know if like Sony and Nintendo and stuff actually provide that data to devs, or is it just
what you actually get is that achievements and trophies tell you how many players are getting there.
Gotcha.
Like the percentages. See, that's actually anybody can do that. Just go look at the trophy list and just see, because I know the Act 3 achievements on Silk Song, they were like 4%, 2%, 3%.
Yeah.
I was in almost any narrative game, you probably lose half or more of the players in the first level, and then, you know, and then it just continues to drop off. Very small percentage of players actually finish any game.
Yeah, that's why I do wonder what the Game Pass model trains players to do as well, right? Because I saw Doom the Dark Ages, it has 6 million players or 7 million players, and I'm like, yeah, but how many people actually played it for longer than 10 minutes? Like, you don't actually have that data, so it's hard to know, because that's actually an important metric. But what's the completion rate of Act 2, do you know, on Steam?
I don't. Be worth looking up.
Yeah, be worth looking up. I have to find out. It'd probably be quite high,
probably lower than you think is my guess. That's normal, honestly. That's a successful game. People who play a third of your game, that's a success. Maybe not what you envision as a game developer, but that is how it goes.
Well, what do game devs care more about? Like, the sales of the game or how many people actually finish the game?
Depends on the developer. Depends on what they want to do. Selling games means you get to sell more games in the future. So even if you're not money motivated, like, you want your game to be a success because you want to keep making games. You want to keep providing something to your players. You want fans. But yeah, we make this stuff for people to play. Like, we hope that you play it.
Yeah. But, I mean, it's one of those things because you want as many people to play it as possible, but is that more important than sales? Because you need sales to justify work on the next game or to keep the studio running. So,
my personal feeling is I want to be successful enough to keep the lights on, and I want to find my fans. So if millions of people play my game and 100,000 or 10,000 of them are super hardcore fans and I found them, that's awesome.
Yeah. And I suppose, like, with the development pipeline, I mean, how much time do you invest into certain things, right? Because, like, if you're spending a huge portion of your time on the ending of a game and not everybody makes it to the end, is it better to maybe invest that time, like, fine-tuning the introduction more, or the tutorial section, or maybe an earlier act within the game?
That's a tough question, and it is a thing you'll see sometimes, that the game's quality degrades over time. Mm. I've also got a thing where I'm sure you've heard about vertical slices, or basically it's a production deliverable, which is like, we'll make a tiny piece of the game, but make it all the way through, and this will be our thesis to the publisher. Like, this is what our game is, and it gets you greenlit for the rest, and it shows that you're production ready. I like to play a game called Spot the Vertical Slice whenever I play a game, which is that the quality will go bloop and then keep, because it's just noticeably different. And they'll also design the level so that it tries to have something of everything in it. And, you know, and if that's not the way the game is designed, it's like, hey, there's the vertical slice.
Interesting.
You know, we're all human. We're trying to make a uniform product, but, you know, we succeed at different levels.
Yeah, but, well, the cool thing is, like, you look at things through a different lens completely to me, or, like, the average Joe Schmo, right? Because you'll be able to see things and nuances that other people won't necessarily pick up, right? I mean, I don't know if you had your hat on the entire time, your development hat on the entire time you were playing Silksong. Or were there moments where you could kind of, you just got lost in it and you weren't thinking, oh, they did this here and they did that there and they wonder why they did this?
I kind of do both at the same time all the time, to be honest.
Okay.
I can't turn it off. But I did have real emotional reactions. Like, I didn't get stomped by the beast fly and go like, ah, interesting. I was like, motherfucker, I was so pissed off. So I am having a genuine reaction.
Yeah. That's funny. I don't want to go for too long, so I will wrap up there, but this has been cool, bro. Getting your thoughts on everything and your thoughts on Silksong, and will you go back to it, or you're done now? Totally done.
Well, 97% complete. Am I going to go get the last two? I don't know where those mask shards are or whatever. No, I don't think I'll go back. Not yet. I may go back to it again. This has been a highlight. I think it's easy, especially as a developer, to sound very critical, but I enjoyed my time with this game. It was what I wanted out of a Hollow Knight sequel, and was surprising too. So, my hats off to the developers, and I think they deserve their success.
Yeah, and there'll probably be DLC on the way. I imagine so.
My God, what? I just imagine DLC on top of what we already have. Like, that would be insane.
Well, I did read, because they did a small snippet interview with Jason Schreier, and they did say they released the game because they felt they had to, because they'd left it too long. Mm-hmm. But they still had heaps of ideas that they wanted to implement. So my guess is that'll be saved for the DLC. Whatever that is, I have no idea.
And, interesting to see what they come out with.
Yeah. I mean, kudos to them. Multi-millionaires with Scrooge McDuck money, and that they haven't lost their passion, so that's good.
I wonder how much of it they get to hang on to, you know. There's always...
Well, I know they're extremely wealthy. Like, I okay. know. Yeah, they are extremely wealthy. They were already wealthy from Hollow Knight. Obviously, like Steam and all the platforms take a 30% cut, but like when you've only got three main developers and you disperse that around, and obviously they had some playtesters and a composer and stuff, but for the most part, yeah, they're doing pretty well, man.
Good work if you can get it. Yeah, must be nice.
Yeah, yeah. But Joe, man, this has been cool. It's been well overdue for us to do this again, so thank you so much. Is there any plugs or anything you want to do before we wrap up?
Nah, I'm just around.
Yeah, just around. Riot Games.
I'll put out a game eventually, with my, and then I hope people play it.
They will play it, I'm sure. Cool. All right, well, that is the show, everyone. Make sure you share, like, and subscribe. And until next time, stay safe.